Welcome back to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. This is a big one, and I'm so excited to have this person on. Ron English comes on to start and kick off his series to archive and detail the art in his life. If you want to jump in for more Toys on Tap, you can follow us on all socials at Toys on Tap. If you want to jump on and support the show in a free way, you can like, rate, review wherever you get podcasts. And if you would like to step it up and support us, you can jump on the Patreon, patreon.com/toysontap. It means the world. For as little as $1 a month, you can support us. For as little as $3 a month, you'll get video interviews, nitty-gritty, and all kinds of good stuff. Now let's jump into this week's epic episode of Toys on Tap. So please.
So anyway, yourself. Hi. Yeah, my name is Ron English. I'm a lifelong artist since the beginning of the 1960s, and I've been involved in pop surrealism, street art, installation art, music, and you name it, I've probably had my hand in.
Oh, it's crazy. This almost feels like a surreal moment because I've seen your work, I've seen everything that's happened. I'm only 30 years old, and I just remember seeing flashes of your work growing up or from people that were talking about it, and then seeing your work with Dove, and it just feels like a weird moment right now where I get to experience this. So thank you so much for making time today.
Thank you.
We want to start kind of way back. Growing up, that kind of stuff, where art kind of filtered into your life as a kid, maybe even toys, the pop culture that was there, if there was any that were significant. Let's start all the way back in childhood. So tell me what it was like growing up and how that goes.
Well, when I was a child, I got 10 cents a week allowance, and there was a dime store. They called them Five and Dimes, and 90% of the stuff in the store was five or dime. And so I used to go collect these little dinosaurs. And my God, I've never been able to find them since. They were cheap. They had like a hole in the middle. They were just like a one-shot plastic toy. Mm-hmm. And I'd take them home and I would hand paint them all. So I was kind of obsessed with those things. And maybe my first revelation was that, you know, somebody sculpts these, right? Somebody has a job sculpting these somewhere. Because, you know, at that point, it was the Vietnam War. And if I imagined a future for myself, it was probably that before I could even get like a date or anything, you know, that young men would look forward to, that I would probably be sent to Vietnam and killed, you know. And I think they were killing like one person every other block on in my town, because we were poor and that's who they were recruiting for the most part.
Yeah.
So, the idea that I could actually be sculpting toys was, you know, a very distant kind of dream, but I did understand that somebody was sculpting these, and I had a relationship with them because I was hand painting each one.
That is a really, for a child to have that kind of, I didn't have that revelation until I finally met Scott Hensey about the toys that I played with when I was a kid. So to have that as a kid, that's pretty deep thoughts about a toy.
Yeah. Yeah, I could start to discern some were better sculpts than others. And also, I kind of had a concept that it was very related to comic books, in that this wasn't something, that there was a person who ran this company who said, sculpt it in a day. You know, the way that I used to buy these records, and they were $1 a piece, and it was all fake bands. Mm-hmm. And they would tell a lot of these guys to come in. Matter of fact, I think Lou Reed worked at one of these kind of companies when he was very young. But they would say, they would want you to make 3 songs a day, write, record, you know, bang. And they were just to distribute to kids like me for a buck for an album. And I assumed the toys were probably made the same way, that the sculptor probably didn't have a month to work on the toy. They probably were under the gun because they were about making money. And so that they were living under those kind of conditions. And, you know, I've always been kind of intrigued by those super high pressure situations where that you don't have a long time to work on something, and, you know, we need it like 5 minutes ago. So, well, you know, that's very intriguing. obviously I spend tons of time on my art, but I'm also, I kind of really thrive in those situations where we're under very strict deadlines.
Yeah.
And it kind of produces like a different, you take a different attitude. It's kind of like with a lot of people get really good doing graffiti. Well, but you're not precious about graffiti because you know that maybe even 2 hours after you paint it, it will be painted over. It's not going to last. So you don't have that thing. It's like, what are people going to think about it in 1,000 years? You're thinking, what are they going to think about it in 10 minutes? You know, so it kind of loosens you up, you know, so you're not precious about things.
Yeah, there's a phrase for those little, I mean, they're probably not the same, but I remember little dinosaurs when I was a kid, and they were, I mean, I've heard people call them like Chinasaurs now.
Chinasaurs.
And it's, that doesn't seem to give the same oomph that you're talking about with people sculpting them.
China tends to make things cheaper.
And
that they're often less concerned about quality than, like, we would associate the Japanese toy makers with obsession with quality and the highest quality materials and everything. But when I was a kid, made in Japan, it's cheap.
Yeah.
You know, it's mass produced and it's cheap. And some of the stuff that I kind of like now, like the kaiju figures, the OG kaiju figures, they were made just for kids, and probably they figured they'd be in a waste bin after 2 years of the kid playing with them. But they weren't made for us, you know, 60 years later to be obsessing with and collecting. But I think that freedom of just like, okay, come up with 10 ideas today. It's like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, and you have, you know, your standard issue ideas, you know, in the morning, and then by afternoon you've run out of ideas, which means that you actually have to be creative.
Yeah.
You know, most of us aren't. Yeah. I think that in your life, God bless, if you have one original thought, I mean, that's a miracle. But most people never have a single original thought in their whole life, you know, and that's scary. And I think that depresses people. But a way to have an original thought is just force everything out of yourself and do everything you've ever thought of and then say now more. And then you're a lot more likely to actually have an original concept, you know.
Yeah, because that kind of plays into that. There's that like proverb or whatever that says that everything's been done before. And I think that that's a daunting thing to say to someone that like, I'll never. And so to hear you say that you might have one original thought is at least a little hope at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. Not that original thought's going to do you any good whatsoever. it's, they also say like one of the things I tell young people, it's like, well, you got two choices. You can pave the road or you can, you know, rent a Ferrari and drive down the road, or you know what I mean? But if you're actually the pioneer, you're going to have a very hard life. But if you're somebody that comes like after the pioneer, and once they've like kind of created this art and that the public has decided they liked it, because it takes them a long time to acclimate to a new idea. But once they've acclimated and embraced the new idea, then you could run with that idea. But you don't want to be the guy having the idea. I mean, it's intriguing to have original stuff and push things forward. And it's kind of romantic, but it's not financially beneficial, you know?
Yeah. I mean, your career speaks to the reality of like original thought or playing with things that exist in new ways. And so, I mean, you talked about painting those little dinosaurs from a young age. So what is art looking like in your early childhood ages up until we hit maybe like 10, 12, maybe teenage years?
Well, originally I was probably, you know, making comic books, but just stapling them together, not for anybody, and making little dioramas with my toys and setting them on fire and taking pictures and not dissimilar to what I was doing yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, building a set and photographing it and fogging it and then using that as the basis for the painting or the drawing. So I'm kind of doing the exact same thing that I've always been doing. But yeah, and also making comic books. So I make a lot of the comic books are digital now for a platform called Vivi. But, you know, sometimes I still make a physical comic book. So I'm still doing the kind of the same thing. And then later, I bought an 8mm movie camera and we started making movies. And I kind of got better and better in that by, you know, seeing what audiences responded to and, you know, going a little farther with it.
Godzilla!
It looks like Godzilla, but due to international copyright laws, it's not.
Still, we should run like it is Godzilla!
Though it isn't.
The newest kaiju is about to stomp its way onto the scene.
What's that smell?
Meet Barfy. The sludge-spewing kaiju inspired by the lizard we all know and love. Coming from the brain of Bootleg Toy Co. and brought to life by Toys on Tap. This monstrosity will come in at a massive 6 inches in 3 styles. 1 blank white and 2 colorways exclusive to Toys on Tap. The first colorway is Barfy's natural colors. And the second is... That's right. Reptar colorway.
Now that's entertainment!
This monstrosity will arrive in a clear box with a backer that doubles as a backdrop for your figure. Barfy arrives on the scene soon. You don't want to miss this, but remember, stay out of the way of the sludge.
You know, each time.
I was really hoping you were going to say that you are still currently setting dinosaurs on fire.
That I still set things on fire for photos, yeah. Like I have a painting of like Kenny on fire.
Mm-hmm.
But how I did it is I sculpted a life-size Kenny of South Park, and then I put him in the same kind of jacket, and then I, you know, I took him out in the snow, you know, because they're always in the snow, and you know, lit him on fire, and then that's how I got that super photorealistic painting of him, is because there was a really beautiful photo to work from. And that's when we were doing a show for I hooked up with the South Park guys on one of their anniversaries, and I had got a bunch of artists together and did a show with everybody doing South Park stuff. But so I still use that. I still set things on fire sometimes.
Yeah. you get
not,
this
not myself anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. Thankful. We're thankful for that. We need you around for a little
longer. It's interesting to be, you know, that almost everything I've done became a thing. So mm-hmm. Like when we were setting ourselves on fire and making movies, and then we would just show them like in school. You know, that became Jackass, or that became what, you know, people do like stupid things on TikTok. So it became a thing, but the technology wasn't there to disseminate what we were doing. We had to kind of create situations to disseminate it on a smaller level. But it's kind of like almost everything that's happened. Oh, yeah, we do these big street art festivals. Well, we were doing that in the early 80s, but I was getting a whole bunch of people, and we were taking over a bunch of billboards and then having a keg party underneath. So we were creating a festival, like that was a public festival. I guess ours was like the second degree felony, and theirs is not, but the new ones are not. But no, I mean, when I talked about, you know, paving the road and or being the person that drives down the road afterwards, so in my life, a lot of times I've circled back, and so maybe I did pave the road, and then, but I make sure that, you know, when the road is paving and it actually becomes a thing, and people are actually, this becomes a thing, that I get involved with it on that level. So I did like all the street art festivals around the world too, you know? So
yeah.
I feel like if I kind of push forward this culture, you know, and I was the one that went through the jungle chopping down the road, that, you know, when we're all driving our Ferraris down the road, I'm going to make sure I got my Ferrari there too, you know?
Yeah. Which, I mean, I can't take, there's probably thousands and thousands of people that do this type of stuff and never get to interact with the first person that maybe paved the road for it. So this is, it's huge to do this. Those movies that you were filming and lighting each other on fire, doing dumb stuff. Tell me about some of those. I mean, you can, because back then you're just taking the stuff and taking it to school, showing them, and then does it just get thrown away? Do you store, like, what happens?
All my childhood movies that I made with my friends are at the Museum of Modern Art.
Oh my gosh, amazing.
So they have them all, and they archive them, and they digitize them all, and so that's where they are.
Yeah. So I'm going to somehow figure out how to find you lighting yourself on fire.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also on YouTube. I think pictures of it. Yeah. Awesome. Oh, and the new movie, Living in Delusionville, I think he shows some of those clips.
Awesome. Awesome. As you enter high school.
It's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
You always got to promote, right?
Yeah. as you enter high school or enter maybe even middle school, you have some kind of art thing that's brewing in you, regardless if you know what it is or not. Mm-hmm. And I think that high school art classes have a tendency to squash that sometimes unintentionally. What did it look like for you to kind of start art, maybe in school and art classes and things?
Well, in high school, my art teacher's name was Mr. Taylor. We lived in a small town in the Midwest that was very, very conservative. The art scene in our town, which was not much of an art scene, people showed at the malls. Mm-hmm. Or I think this is even before the malls, they showed outdoors. So like an avant-garde artist would paint a barn and a normal artist would paint a flower. And that was the spectrum of, and even when I returned to the town for the movie Living in Delusionville, because he wanted me to go back to my hometown and paint a mural. So I did. And they were like, what are you going to paint? Because you know what? I'm a liberal. I don't care if you paint Lincoln or bear. And you realize the only thing that you can paint in this town is a bear or Lincoln. And a bear because the Chicago Bears started in Decatur, Illinois, and Lincoln because I guess he took a piss there. and it's like, so I did Elefanka, you know, which was, I made her because I had a huge reputation for being controversial. And I just thought, going back to my hometown, I'm not interested in making controversy. I'm interested in just gifting them something and, you know, getting to talk to some of the old people. But I really didn't want to create a firestorm. But I ended up doing it because I didn't do Lincoln or Bear, but also because I think that because they expected me to be controversial, they try to figure out why is this elephant, little cute little elephant with monarch ears, why is she controversial? And then they said, oh, he's making fun of the president's wife. He's trying to say they want to be monarchs and blah, blah, blah. And they just pulled that out of their ass. But yeah, because they were looking for something to be controversial, they found it. But yeah, so in that town, there was very little to do artistically. But again, back to Mr. Taylor, he was a bit different. He had a little handlebar mustache, and I'm, you know, looking back, he was very conservative because he beat like all my bad habits out of me my freshman year. I think he saw I had some talent. You know, he probably every year he's looking for some little kid that kind of actually into art. So, yeah, he taught me to dump color into all the shadows and all the things that, you know, I still use. And he beat me out of my bad habits. So I started becoming a better artist very quickly, thanks to his guidance. But then, of course, I came to annoy him as I became more controversial. Because, like, they put me on the school paper and I had a monkey peeing on a fire hydrant and the dog standing there watching him. And he goes, hey, you know, now it's my turn or whatever. But my stuff, and I wasn't trying to be even controversial. It just turned out that's the way my mind worked. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think early on, I started interacting with the public in different ways, which I think is very helpful for an artist. And then I got my first real job, like emptying ashtrays at the bowling alley for $4 an hour. And then I got offered this other job for $2 an hour being an artist. So I switched to that job. And so I did advertising specialties and I drew the mock-ups for stuff. And but the cool thing about the guy I worked with is he was a weird guy and he had a house out on the lake. And I guess you would have called him a freak or a hippie or something. I don't know what. He ran an underground comic book that was only disseminated between a couple of towns. So I got to draw underground comics and then also have them kind of get out there. So I think that was a big step for me.
That's, like, I love the idea that you had a better paying job and still went towards the other one because it made you happy.
Yeah, yeah. I'm an idiot. But all of this are idiots. Yeah, we're the only people I know that are kind of really not capitalistic and because our main impetus is to create great art. And it seems secondary to making the money part. That seems to be almost universal with artists. And ones that aren't that way usually stand out. Mm-hmm. You know, like you notice the ones that don't seem to, they seem to care more about the fastest route to money as opposed to their artistic vision.
Yeah. It seems interesting when you encounter those people, because it's, I think I've heard, even in the small amount of time I've done art, like even when people have said something like, oh, I just want to make a quick buck, or my goal is to make money here to this, like it shows in your work. It shows that, like, that's what you're doing.
Well, it's not that difficult, because again, like I said, once something's accepted, then if you do what's accepted, then public's already decided they like that. So they're not going to care if you steal from another artist. They've just decided they like Hello Kitty. And if you make a Hello Kitty, even though you don't really have the copyright, they'll buy Hello Kitty, you know. But, you know, somebody created Hello Kitty, and probably fortunes were spent to promote Hello Kitty to the point where we know who Hello Kitty is, you know. It's a weird thing. It's just weird. It's a weird profession maybe the only one, or one of the few that I've ever found where people aren't money obsessed. They're more like coming up with something original, or doing something really high quality, or they're a bit of a different breed. And the other interesting thing about artists is it's you're never a part of the ruling class, but you kind of weirdly have access to everybody. So it's not uncommon for you to be hanging out with a janitor one day and Obama the next day, and then being at a billionaire's house the next day, and then being with some junkies in Harlem the next day. Or do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have a kind of a wide access to society that I think a lot of people don't have.
That is an interesting way to look at it. I mean, because you worked, your first art style job is this advertising thing, which immediately gives you access to everyone, because your ads are out there.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because, again, I, you know, back to the, like, pushing artists too hard and making them crank out stuff is not actually detrimental to them in the long run.
Empire Blister. Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 3.75-inch or 1/18-2. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now sponsor Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's COYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters.
My first day there, I was scared, and I came in and he says, well, I need a t-shirt of a guy playing guitar for this local guitar shop called Axe in Hand. Oh yeah, I know them. You know, I've been my idea. They were famous. I don't know. And so I was excited. That's a great first gig for this guy. And then, and I said, well, let me go home, and I got some circus magazines that have pictures of guitars, and let me kind of work the whole thing out. I'll come back maybe tomorrow and have to do something, or the next day. And, you know, I need my little time at home and to sort this out. And he goes, yeah, that all sounds great, except the guy's on his way over here right now. So, yeah, you don't get like 2 days to work on this. You get like 40 minutes, you know. And I was scared shitless. But because I didn't lean on my references and copy them, I did something far better, because I stretched out the perspective of the guitar and made, you know, I really twisted the drawing into something that would have been better than just a weird photorealistic drawing. So that pressure made me create something great. And then, you know, then the 2 weeks later, you see people walking around with the shirt, which was a really good feeling.
You know? Yeah. How old are you at this point when you get this job?
I would be 16 at that point.
Okay, so still in high school, still cranking away with art stuff.
Yeah, and not the back then. Your parents paid your rent, and they bought you a certain amount of clothes. And if you wanted more clothes, or if you wanted weed or movie film, that you were going to pay for that yourself. So that's what your job was for. It wasn't like you really needed money.
Yeah,
kind of like I used to take my son to Comic-Con and. And then he would sell like all the stuff, you know, that he got for free at all the events that we went to. And sometimes he'd make like $7,000 or whatever. But I at that time, I didn't explain to him. It's like, you're not really making money, because I have to pay for like a hotel room. I have to pay for plane tickets, you know. And so there's a lot of expense to go in to put you into that party where you're going to get some free toys. So yeah, it's just weird. Like when you're in high school, all that money is your money. And
yeah.
You don't really have to think about that. Somebody else is putting a roof over your head, paying for the food.
Yeah.
Work for some crazy artist for $2 an hour.
Yeah. When we've talked kind of about this creativity thing. I mean, you're trying to be creative in your own right and do your own stuff and comic books and film. You're kind of doing this art thing at school where you're learning as you go with Mr. Taylor. And then you're also doing this creative thing at this agency. So how are you keeping that flowing?
Well, my relationship with Mr. Taylor by that point had fallen off.
Okay.
He wants to have me do like big murals in the hall and stuff. And, the fonts going, hey, stay in school, you know. But I was becoming more hippie-ish and degenerate. So my relationship by that point had deteriorated. And I think maybe at some point I was showing the movies in an English class, and I had lit somebody on fire, and it was a serious fire. And they didn't actually get hurt in that fire. But they realized, you know, she goes, that's amazing how you make it look like he's on fire. You know, and how do you achieve that effect? And she was so impressed. And I was like, oh, you know, you just douse the motherfucker in charcoal lighter and light a match, and it's that easy. You know, and she was mortified, and I'd mortified. So I was an outlaw by the end. And, they even had an art award called the Gary Harris Art Award. It was an artist kid that had died in a car wreck, and so his family put up a little fund. It wasn't much, but and everybody in the school goes, you know, I mean, that goes to Ron. I mean, he just crushes everybody in the school. I mean, we're in a small town in the Midwest, probably wasn't easy to crush everybody in the school, but I mean, there was no doubt. And then they went to the parents and said, look, he's going to get it. The kids are going to vote for him. But this is bad. He's a bad boy, you know, and we don't want to send that message. So for this one year, can we make the art award like a good citizenship award instead of an art award? And so by the end of school, I was kind of a bit of an outlaw.
Mm-hmm.
But weirdly, being that person, you don't think of yourself as a bad person. You think of yourself as like, this is just who I am. You know, I think I just expanded beyond their vision of what a person or an artist should be.
Yeah. And I think what it sounds like too is, though it may have been mischievous, it wasn't necessarily like criminal, right? Like you were still doing things within the bounds of laws, and you were still making art and doing stuff. It just happened to not fit their scope.
Yeah, I don't know if I was completely lawful about everything I did, but we were kids, and we realized, oh, if you jump off the bridge, it's a crime to jump off the bridge, and it's also a crime to commit suicide. So if you jump off the bridge, you better fucking drown.
Yeah.
Because if you have a failed suicide, then you get nailed with the attempted suicide as a crime, or I don't know. We're just kind of like, as all kids do, you know, just trying to, what the fuck is all this shit? And who thought up all this stuff? And what's right, righteous, and what's not? I think you kind of have an innate sense of morality.
Yeah.
The weird thing about being young is you probably do have a very keen sense of morality as opposed to an older person, because, you know, nobody becomes corrupt in an instant. You become corrupt over a lifetime, you know. Now I have to start paying rent. Well, maybe my morals are going to lower a little bit so I can pay rent. Oh, now I got a mortgage. So you become more embedded in the society and more accepting of things that may not be righteous, because you got more of a stake in it, you know?
So yeah.
Back then you are kind of weirdly pure, you know?
Yeah.
But pure at heart, you know?
Yeah. I work with kids, and a lot of times I will have told them, you're not going to become evil tomorrow. Like it's not going to be, you're going to wake up and mass murder, but your little decisions could lead to anywhere. Who knows what they're going to do? So maybe don't do that stupid thing.
Yeah. And there's not a single person on planet Earth that would perceive themselves as evil.
Yeah.
They may think I have to make some compromises for a greater good or blah, blah, blah. But there's nobody that says, yeah, I'm the evil one. You know, they all think they're doing something.
Yeah. As you started, you kept going. I mean, that's a bummer that they switched it potentially to a citizenship award. Did it go back to the art and you got it?
Well, I think I only, I think I only even remember that. Yeah, they did switch it back to art.
Okay.
It's because I think that Constant, who was making the movie Living in Delusionville, he's looking for points where you something switches, where you have like a point of impact where now you take a curve into another direction. And for storytelling, you need that. So he was looking for a precise moment in my high school. And at the time, I gave that story to him and he used that story to help tell the story he wanted to tell. But, at the time, I wasn't even bothered. I saw that happen, but it wasn't anything that affected me because my life didn't exist inside the school. My life existed with my movies and working for this guy and making the underground comic books. And so, like, I did a couple of the school plays where I painted the backdrops, but I'd rather paint backdrops for my productions, not that. So my soul didn't exist in the school. So he couldn't hurt me in the school, and or it wasn't high on my level of attention that had happened. It didn't hurt me. I wasn't upset about it. And I liked the guy that got it. And I thought, you know, and he was more of a competent artist than a great artist, but I love the guy. Everybody in the school loved the guy. I still love the guy, you know, and I felt bad that they put that in the film, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's this guy. I'll say his name cause he's in the film, but his name is Todd Bracken. But sometimes they would give us the answers to the test. You know, we didn't come from the greatest school system. Mm-hmm. And then you just to get us through a test or whatever. And, but I mean, the teachers gave us the answers and said, just, you know, put them on there or whatever. And then he told an older guy that he made a snarky thing that he was going to cheat on a test. And he was saying it kind of snarky and he thought he would have preferred that he had to study and do the test the right way. And he was just trying to be funny, you know, but he wasn't cheating on the test, you know. And then 40 years later, when we went to our high school reunion, he went and found the guy and just wanted to explain to him. It's like, I didn't cheat on a test, you know. So that would be somebody of a very high moral caliber. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, I think that he was kind of still, I think that it bothered, like, okay, you know, and we're kids, the stuff's being forced on us. So you're winning the award. Okay, I'm winning the award. But yeah, he probably thought, why doesn't Ron get it? You know, and he didn't realize that the kids didn't vote it. But you know, it wasn't really a big issue for either one of us. It, you know, it's sort of something that got made into something by the guy making the movie.
Yeah. You said something in passing that I kind of want to ask you about before we keep going. You said he was a competent artist, not a great one. Can you explain the difference for you?
He was tackling perspective. He wasn't doing anything original yet. But okay. I mean, what high school kid is? It's rare. You know?
Yeah.
But I don't believe that he took any drugs or anything, or, you know. He was like the good guy. His hair was short.
Yeah.
It's 1975, 1976. Like, I looked at my yearbook and, well, because my dad was a barber and he had decided that I had talked everybody in town to growing their hair long. And my hair was to my waist at that point. So I was a little more extreme than the other kids. But yeah, I think that everybody had grown their hair long. And that's just what we did. And it was weird. A couple of the kids that didn't. And they were, I remember once I brought one of the short haired kids home. And my parents actually kind of saw through that. And the kids saw through it, too. It's like, you don't really want to be my friend. You just want to show your parents you know something with short hair.
Yeah.
You know? But, yeah, so my dad was a barber, and he was convinced that I had talked to everybody and grown their hair long. It'd be great if I could have done that. But it sort of happened nationally. So yeah. Beals fucking did it. I don't know.
But, as you, you graduate or you come to the end of high school and you start to think through college and stuff. And I believe you went to University of North Texas, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
first I went to junior college, which is kind of an interesting because I wasn't expecting to go to college to begin with. But I didn't get the job at the factory because, you know, that my hair was probably too long or maybe they could tell I was on acid. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, the acid thing, that's not my fault either, you know, like that kind of became a story of, you know, but I'd taken it the day before and I didn't understand at that point that it lasted that long. So
yeah.
Like 8 o'clock the next morning, I'm still fucking loaded, you know, but yeah, so I was kind of fucked because I didn't get the job at the factory. And then Then I got arrested and got a felony, and then I had saved up some money to maybe go to college, or I didn't really know what I was doing because I never met anybody that went to college. But after that I paid off the judge to get through a lawyer, then I was broke, and then my uncle offered me a job hanging sheet or remodeling the projects in Dallas. So I went to Dallas and worked for him. I wasn't really planning on going to college. And then after like a couple of years of that, I realized that once I'd been a resident of Texas for a year, that I could go to college very cheap because the oil companies subsidized the colleges. So junior college was almost nothing. And so when I was at junior college, I worked at a factory full time and then went to the junior college. And then when I went to the regular college, I think a semester was like $120.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I don't know how somebody like me ever got to college, but it changed everything, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I want to hear about college, but we passed over the fact that you got a felony. What was the felony for?
Well, they dropped it.
Okay.
I actually punched a cop. I had taken some Quaaludes or something, and I remember we had Billy Beer.
Yeah.
So I was arrested for five things: possession of Billy Beer, driving while under the influence of narcotics. I don't know. I didn't want to go work at the factory. It stunk to high heaven. People died very young there. I don't know. I was very depressed, probably, and saw no future.
Yeah.
And I loved art, but I had no fucking idea how one would do that, you know?
So, man.
That's why I said that by the time I got to college, it's like suddenly like a whole new world opened up to me.
Yeah.
Not that anybody knew how to make a living at it. None of my teachers, the only way they knew how to make a living in art was, you know, being a teacher. But I don't know. I figured it out.
Yeah. In junior college, I mean, you're doing the factory job and doing that.
But junior college is kind of interesting because for multiple reasons. One, it's like you had all the clay you could use. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. So I made giant sculptures and put them in the woods and stuff and took photos of them. So that kind of started me on that journey. And the other people in the school were interesting because they weren't kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was an architect that retired or an engineer that retired and looked forward to being an artist his whole life. And now he's going on the artistic journey. Or like one of my best friends in junior high was in Vietnam, and I didn't know that. But, you know, I mean, I was old enough to go to Vietnam, but I just missed it. So I was curious about Vietnam, and we would smoke weed. And, you know, he's like, yeah, I killed my fucking sergeant, you know. And it's like, you could do that? And it's like, dude, you could do whatever the fuck you want in Vietnam, you know. Because once you're out there, yeah, fuck it. It's like, you know, the guy's been yelling at you. Everybody just decided to stand up one day and shoot him. And there's nothing nobody knows they did that, you know. I just thought, what an interesting guy. And I wouldn't have met him in college, you know, because it would have been kids fresh off their parents' ranch or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have met interesting people like that.
You did that, which is crazy that they had unlimited supplies. You're doing that. You're putting them in the woods, taking pictures. When did you transfer to North Texas?
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this.
Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet.
Oh my, we're doomed.
Wait, salvation. Hooray, we're saved, DOV2. Limited edition custom artist made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures!
DKE!
But back to those, they were kind of interesting because, you know, I could sculpt them, fire them,
mm-hmm.
and like I would make weird, like alien dinosaur skeletons, and then I would, maybe they'd just be in a creek bed, or maybe they would be in, we had a lot of cliffs in Dallas and in Austin too, so like I would embed them in the side of a cliff. So like if somebody's going on a hike, you kind of look over the cliffs and you think, what the fuck? There's a dinosaur skeleton kind of emerging out of the rocks. At that point, I was making stuff to be discovered. like, so I was at that point a street artist, or
yeah.
I made fake products and put them into stores. So that wanting to do stuff in public and have people kind of stumble upon it was already in full activation.
Which
and
is,
also I had unlimited cardboard, so I was doing all the cardboard cutouts and taking them to weird dive bars and stuff. So I already had like an artistic practice, just not an artistic profession.
Yeah, and being willing to like put your artwork out there in a different way. Usually it's like, oh, I want to get my artwork out there in front of eyes. You did it, and it was just like embedding it in the, which that's way more interesting to me, that there's an alien dinosaur somewhere in a cliff.
Yeah, but the weird part is it, you didn't get a lot of feedback.
Yeah.
Sometimes you did, but mostly you didn't. Like I used to do, we used to, a lot of times when we made my art, my crew, because I did need help, I would just give them free beer. And I, you know, so I knew how to get like beer, like free.
Yeah.
And I'd give them free beer and they would do stuff. But a lot of it was driving around drinking. So sometimes we would take my car and I would tape off like one of the headlights. And then I'd have people stand like by buildings in Dallas, like alleys and stuff. And then I would paint their shadow in. So sometimes if you came back the next day, which rarely we did, yeah, you could see people like trying to figure out where the fucking shadow was coming from, you know? So that was kind of tickled me. And so sometimes you would meet people that encountered the art, but mostly you never really knew what their experience was because there was no feedback loop like Instagram now or anything.
Yeah. And there's something that's cool about that you just made to make, and I think that we lost that a lot.
Yeah, I think it's because I had a factory job or I had different kinds of jobs, so I didn't. Yeah, I just, art was like a fun thing we did. That was a social activity that we did.
Yeah,
I still hadn't figured out, sorted out how somebody could make money off art.
What
I wasn't supposed to make money. And a lot of the kids that hung around with me, honestly, I think they thought that somehow I was going to figure out how to monetize this and that was going to be our jobs from then on to go out and do crazy stuff. But
yeah, which is like the dream. What did art start to look like as you transferred to North Texas? Same?
Yeah. I think they were kind of weirdly intrigued with me at North Texas. And they were also probably the sweetest town I ever lived in. The professors were tenured, so they didn't give a fuck. I started in the photography department because I kind of developed that weird trompe l'oeil thing with my photographs in junior college. So I kind of wanted to pursue that more. But yeah, like so... If you're developing a photo and you can't figure out why it looks flat or what are you doing wrong, then you would want to talk to your teacher, right? So my teacher would be over at the sandwich break, like a place where they had pictures of beer for a buck each, and all the teachers would be over there drinking in the middle of the day, and they'd go over there and they say, "You sure don't want a beer?" You know, and it's like, "No, I just want to understand why this looks so flat." You know, it's like, "Well, you got to leave it this longer." You know, "Well, thank you, sir." You know, and then But yeah, they were very relaxed and you'd see them at the parties and stuff. Because they had tenure, you couldn't fire them.
Yeah.
So that was the first time I thought, there's a job I would like to have as art teacher, because it's like you can't get fired. They give you all these free supplies, free studio, air conditioning in Texas is like a miracle. I don't think I ever had air conditioning when I lived in Texas, you know.
But murderous.
Yeah. Well, it's how you kind of deal with that is like at night, night's the hardest. So you take a cold shower and then you put a fan on yourself and lay naked in the bed and it kind of evaporates the water and helps you go to sleep. But I mean, there's kind of life hacks. And also the buildings were older and they were not built to have air conditioning. So nothing was sealed and everything kind of had a cross breeze kind of built into it. And I'm not saying it was, you know, air conditioning's fun.
Yeah.
That's why I'm in the art building, fucking air conditioning, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first job I thought, man, that's a cool fucking job. And then later, like I worked at a photo studio, and that was a lot of fun too.
When did you get the photo studio job? During college?
Yeah, I got it as you had to get an internship. So I the guys that ran the studio were called the Messina brothers, and they were twin brothers. Interesting thing about twin brothers is one was really handsome and one was really ugly. and they were twins. They're identical twins, by the way. but it's funny, but that's when I realized like everything's just kind of perception, you know? It's kind of like Don Knotts, you know, the guy from Mayberry RFD and, you know, ugly guy, right? You know who he looks exactly like? Mick Jagger. They look, they got the same facial structure, the same big lips, fucking same guys. But one guy has like the fucking attitude, you know? And so he's a big sex symbol. And the other guy who looks just like him was like, oh yeah, holy. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting that these two guys were, once you knew them, you could see differences in them, but you had to really know them before you could start perceiving like the differences. And, but yeah, I thought that was an interesting kind of revelation. But the other thing that those guys, well, I had to do an internship, but they were like, we'll fucking pay you. You know, it's like, we don't understand what an internship is. But I knew them because they were in my uncle's band. So they gave me that job there. And the weird kind of strange thing that happened there is I was into doing the billboard thing. They had a wall, like all the billboards were 11 and a half by 22 and a half feet. They were all standardized, so you could print posters and put them up. They had a wall exactly that size, just a weird random wall. And I think they built it for some shoot. They had a big warehouse kind of studio. And I thought, well, oh my God, I measured the wall. I said, could I ever paint some of my billboards on this wall? They're like, yeah, sure. And it turned out the wall was the same size. And then they also had reams of seamless paper, backdrop paper, that they threw away because the model walked on it, got a little dirty. So now I had like free paper, and now I had a wall to paint on that they didn't mind me painting on. And then I was doing everything like in black and white. And then one time he goes, you know, we did a paint shoot year before last, and we got 100 gallons of paint.
Oh my like gosh!
Yeah, then the whole family got it. Then my uncle's like, he used to buy warehouses and then resell everything in them, you know, because sometimes it's kind of like those guys that buy the storage units, and then maybe it's got something, maybe it doesn't. And,
yeah.
Yeah, so he's like, oh, I found like 50-gallon buckets of fucking pre-mixed glue and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so everybody's kind of pitching and helping me with the billboard. They thought it was hilarious. So, but yeah, that was very serendipitous that they had everything I needed. And I don't know what they ever thought about it, but they I think they thought it was kind of funny. And I'd always try to hit some like along the route to their work so they could see some, you know, so
yeah.
It's helping. But yeah, I don't know. That little things like that kind of change you, you know?
Yeah. Tell me about, I mean, this is kind of where graffiti starts a lot too, right? Somewhere in your college career.
Yeah, I guess I did graffiti, but I never thought that was kind of like a side trip. You know, I was really into doing the billboards.
Okay.
Because I was doing, what they later called fabricated to be photographed, and because I was painting stuff onto walls, like in reverse perspective to facilitate a photograph. When I left, there was a mural on the wall. So I think a lot of people saw that as he's painting on streets, but he's not writing his name in traditional graffiti style. Yeah. So
which
more like a weird art thing.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm assuming no one's doing this during the time that you're doing, like no one had even thought this through. You are again, the pioneer.
Nobody did that yet. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it seems like each part of, like, as you're going, each part has just become one pioneering move after another that you're just, like, paving all this.
Yeah, well, you kind of think, well, I'm a nut job. Why am I doing this? But then later, you know, even, like, with the reverse shoplifting and the making the fake products and stuff, it's like I see a lot of people do that now. You know, I think, like, Meow Wolf is kind of, like, that's, like, the installations that we used to make back in the day. And, yeah, very similar. But I think that now people know how to monetize stuff.
You know? Yeah.
They see, like, finally, you know, a lot of kids kind of participate in this kind of behavior. And finally, a money person came in and goes, we could monetize this, you know. This could work.
Yeah. At the end of your college career, did you finally start to figure out other ways that you could monetize art versus just being an art teacher? Or were you still kind of foggy in that?
Oh, no. By the end of college, I made my living off art, and which also made – I was in Austin, Texas at that time. And so it made it – it was very – I had like the perfect life. for me, I painted murals for a living. You know, once you do a mural, then you get three more murals. And so I was just painting murals around and then doing the weird billboards. And we would go to Barton Springs and you could get naked and go out in the water up to your nose and still see your feet. The water was so perfect and beautiful and, you know, great bands playing every night. I don't know. That was really hard to leave there because I'd kind of set myself up as an artist.
Yeah.
Frank Kozak was there at the same time.
Wow. 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 Wow.
Yeah. And he was kind of a celeb then, I remember. I remember him being a bit snobby because like sometimes I would curate art shows, but I mean, they weren't in. Like we lived in a big, huge house with a whole bunch of people. So we would curate shows inside the house. And the other guy, Guy Juke, was the big concert artist or whatever, just doing the same thing Frank was. He would participate in our shows, but I remember Frank would kind of snub us a bit. But I don't know. He was a gruff dude. But it was weird that I knew him from Austin all the way up to, you know, San Francisco and New York and, yeah, the whole trip. I think he always thought I was crazy. Uh-huh. And he always, and this is the weird thing with artists, because sometimes you get, well, that guy knows how to make money off art. A lot of time, that's a diss. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. That's just a weird thing about our world. And this isn't a diss at all. I mean, he always knew how to make money. He always knew how to monetize. I mean, he had a great program down in Austin when all the bands would come through and he would do their posters. And he said, I'll give you half and I'll take half. And they're like, yeah, I mean, we're Nirvana. We're nobody yet. I mean, nobody knew who was going to get big and who wasn't. And a lot of those posters, you know, became very valuable because they were Nirvana or the Butthole Surfers. But he always figured out stuff. He always figured out how to make money. So I think he thought I was completely insane, just like painting billboards. Like for what? For what purpose? You know, it's like, How do you make money of that? So I'd say he's always kind of. Yeah, I always think he thought I was. People say there was always something weird between you two guys. And I think it was that he just, and maybe he didn't, but I think he just thinks I'm completely weird and random and kind of weirdly lucky that it always works out. You know,
yeah,
always works out for Ron. but I never think about money. I just think about creating all these things and then a certain percent of them self monetized in some way that I didn't anticipate. So,
yeah.
But yeah, he was interesting because he was always everywhere doing everything first.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think this is a good spot to stop for the next episode. And the next episode, we'll dive further into the billboard stuff and kind of look at that and how it played out and everything. But
yeah, I'll say one thing about billboards. It's like doing illegal billboards. It's not like having a job and crazy fucking shit happens when you're out doing wildly illegal things right in the face.
So, I can't wait.
Next time.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll just split it up between stories of all these illegal escapades. Ron, thank you so much for coming on Toys on Tap and doing episode one of your series. It means the world.
Oh, well, thank you. This is amazing. Thank you.